Esther, chapter 8, finishing this book up. Esther's banquet finished up the 7th chapter where she exposed Haman, that wicked man. Wicked Haman was his name, really, the enemy of the Jews, who pictures for us that Antichrist that will be trying to destroy the Jews in the last days. But he will also fail. And here we're going to see in this next section the problem that Esther and Mordecai, her cousin, have. Even though Haman has been hung on his own gallows that he made for Mordecai, he had caused a problem that was going to be irrevocable. He had declared with the king's signature, or his signet, if you would, that all of the Jews come the 13th day of March. That would be about 8 or 9 months from the time that we're looking at tonight. So in months to come, this edict had been declared by Haman with the ring of the king as a signature. And in Persian law, it was irrevocable once a king made a decree. Even the king himself could not take it back, couldn't change it. So even though Esther here has revealed and exposed Haman's wicked plot to kill and destroy the Jews, and the king has repented from ever allowing that to take place, he still has a huge problem on his hands, because it's not lawful for him to reverse his word. Now, this is important that you note, because here's the kind of the flow through in this particular part of the story. It begins in verse 1 of chapter 8. On that day, now again, they hung Haman, and Mordecai, you see, was freed up. He wasn't going to be threatened by Haman anymore. But on that day did King Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews, the enemy, unto Esther. The Jews' enemy, Haman, his household has been given to Esther now, the queen. So Haman, remember, Haman was a rich man. He offered the king $20 million, basically, to be able to kill all the Jews in the province. So he had a lot of wealth. And the king, rather than keeping that for himself, gives it to Esther, his queen. So she now has the household of Haman at her disposal. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. So the king didn't know that Mordecai was Esther's cousin who had raised her from childhood. But now he does. Esther says to the king, this is Mordecai. He's my adopted father, really. And so now, this is interesting, because now the king and Mordecai are relatives by marriage, aren't they? They're related now because, of course, Esther's the queen married to the king, and now, hey, her cousin now is part of the family, Mordecai. So the king, verse 2, took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gives it now unto Mordecai. The king looks at Mordecai when he's told that, hey, we're related now. And he takes the ring that he had removed from Haman and gives it now to Mordecai. That ring is incredibly significant and valuable because, again, you can sign the letters, a proclamation for the whole country, the whole province, with the king's signature with that ring. Now it's given to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So what a turn of events. Haman, who hated Mordecai and was so disgusted because Mordecai wouldn't bow to him, and then set out to destroy not only him, but all the Jews in the whole province. Now, Haman's whole household, all his wealth, all his money is now in the hand of Mordecai. And Haman's turning over in his grave. He's just fit to be tied because, after all, he hated Mordecai. But this is the way it works in God's economy, isn't it? You don't have to worry, folks, whether or not you're going to be okay. God's going to make it right. Whether it happens in this lifetime or not, eventually everything's made right, you see. And by the way, the psalmist declared that the enemies of God will be put under their feet like a footstool. And here we see that Haman's dead and buried in the ground, and Mordecai's got his stuff. He owns his household and everything that he owned. Now, Esther still understands, and Mordecai both, they understand they've got this huge problem still. They've been exonerated. The king is not going to destroy Mordecai or Esther. He's going to protect them. But the whole rest of the Jewish nation, basically living in Persia, some 15 million people, are still subject to this declaration of death that's going to come in the months ahead. So Esther, verse 3, spake yet again before the king, meaning she went back into his court the second time. She went back in. Remember the first time she went in, she said, if I perish, I perish. You know, I'm going in to talk to him. I got to make this appeal for our people. This time, she just goes on in there. She doesn't go through the if I perish, I perish part. She knows that same risk, but after this whole ordeal, she's figuring, I think we've got some honeymoon period here. And she's gonna capitalize on it. So she goes right back into his presence, right before the king, and falls down at his feet. So there he is on his throne in his court, and she goes in and falls down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman, the Agagite, and his device that he had devised against the Jews. So she goes right in, and before anything, she drops down to her face, down on her knees before the king. Then the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. Remember, that was the key. If that scepter doesn't get extended to the person that comes into the king's court, they're dead. So he extends the golden scepter, and Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the things seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces. She's asking for the impossible, something that cannot be according to the law. And the king knows it. And she goes on, verse 6, for how can I endure to see the evil that shall come unto my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? She can't just sit back in the palace protected without making an appeal for her people. She can't rest while the decree to destroy her people is still in force. And again, can't be revoked here, can't be changed. Verse 7, the king Ahasuerus says unto Esther the queen and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him they have hanged upon the gallows because he laid his hand upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews, as it liketh you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. Now, what the king suggests here is this. Mordecai, you've got my ring. You've got that signet ring that you can make a declaration and put that wax down on the seal and stamp it with the ring, and it's just like the other document that was put out there previously. Now, it doesn't reverse, it doesn't change the other decree. This is important you note this. He's not saying we can reverse this. He's saying write another one, a second declaration, if you would. Now, this is key. And it's so good. This is rich. Because the first one can't be taken back. I mean, it's sealed. It's done. And here's the interesting thing. Verse 9, then were the king's scribes called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day thereof. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews and to the lieutenants and the deputies and rulers of the provinces, which are from India unto Ethiopia, 127 provinces, and unto the province according to the writing thereof, and unto every people and after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing and according to their language. And he wrote in the king Ahasuerus's name and sealed it with the king's ring and sent letters by posts on horseback and riders and mules and camels and young dromedaries, wherein the king granted the Jews which were in every city. Now, this is what he wrote. The Jews in every city are granted to gather themselves together and to stand for their life, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all the power of the people and province that would assault them. So the decree isn't changed. It's just been added to, and what's been stated now that Mordecai has the scribes write up and he seals it, is that on this day, and he'll get there, he'll use the same exact day that the Jews were supposed to be slaughtered. And he says, here's the decree, here's the new proclamation according to the king, that the Jews can stand and fight for their life. And they have the right to destroy anybody that would try and destroy them. Now, this is interesting. The first decree was a death sentence, wasn't it? By the way, the first decree of the law was a death sentence. The first document that we would have to look at from a biblical standpoint, from a spiritual standpoint, is the law. And what was the law? A death sentence. The wages of sin is death. Death to all who would fail at keeping the law. Well, the law that was given by Haman, who was this man that wanted to destroy the Jews, that document was a death sentence, obviously. And in a form, it pictures the law which stood against us that was ready to destroy us. Now, the second document, listen, the second document is good news, isn't it? Just like the gospel is the good news, because it's going to give the people a fighting chance, so to speak, a chance at life instead of death. But here's the issue, here's the situation. And it's just obvious here, the law condemns, of course, but grace, you know, sets us free. This is the whole picture here, but watch this now. They had to believe this second document. People who read this, it was posted up just like the first document, and the people, remember, they believed the first document because they were there in sackcloth and ashes and grieving and mourning over that document that was posted all over the provinces. Remember? They were so upset. They were so sad. They were so grieved. Well, here they have to believe that this second document is just as true. It's going to require faith, which is, of course, the way it always works. Now, they have the right to do this and to take the spoil, verse 11 continues. Now, upon one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. Now, that's the same month that the Jews were going to be destroyed, same day. 13th day of the month Adar or Adar is the time when the Jews were going to be destroyed. So, the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people that the Jews should be ready against that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. Now, keep in mind, there were some 15 million Jews there in Persia, but there was probably in the neighborhood of 100 million Persians. So here's the issue. However many Persians really hated the Jews would be the really deciding factor here. But the Jews were able to stand up and fight off and really assault back, so to speak, those that would come at them. And so it was on the same day, and the copy went to all the provinces that the Jews should be ready against that day. So, verse 14, the posts that rode upon mules and camels went out, being hastened and pressed on by the king's commandment. And the decree was given at Shushan, the palace. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. When Mordecai came out, he's not in sackcloth and ashes this time. He's in his royal apparel, which the king has given him. He has been made now the second in command to the king in all of Persia, a Jew. Interesting. And again, he is coming out in this glorious attire, and the whole place that sees him begins to rejoice. The Jews had light and gladness, verse 16, and joy and honor. Now, this is proof to me that they believed the second decree. They believed the fact that they had now the opportunity for life rather than being condemned to death. Why? Well, because they have this joy and gladness, and they're just light, it says. That's what the gospel does, isn't it? When you hear the news that you're condemned by the law, so to speak, that every sinner is condemned to death, isn't that bad news? Yeah, it's terrible news. But when you've heard, when you finally hear the gospel that, hey, all that can be alleviated, you have a right to live a life with Christ, you get light and glad and joyful because you're not going to die. The law is not going to condemn you like it was before. The Apostle Paul says that the law was nailed to his cross. So there is no more law standing against you. And the wages of sin certainly is death. But for us, that has been paid for. Not taken and changed like the first command. Couldn't be changed, couldn't be altered, couldn't be revoked. And the law, folks, cannot be altered. It's a perfect standard, and it's right that death should ensue after sin. It's the right thing. It's just. It just happens to be immovable. And the problem with it is that we failed at living sinless, and therefore we're subject unto death. So the good news is that we don't have to die. We can live now. And the proof, again, that we believe is that when we have this light, glad, and joyful countenance, I'm going to live. I'm going to make it. You know, I should be put to death, but I'm not going to be. I'm going to heaven, you know. And that's a light, glad, joyful thing. And in every province, verse 17, and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, watch this, the Jews had joy and gladness and a feast and a good day. They just scarfed down and had a good day when they heard this news that was posted up. Now watch, many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. When this was posted and the people saw the response that the Jews had to this good news, it caused an unusual reaction in the people. When they saw that the Jews were glad and joyful and light and having a feast and having a good day, then what happened was the people became afraid and became Jews, many of them, because they saw something of a reality that they did not have. You see, when you and me have a joy and a gladness, and we are having a good day, a feast. We're feasting on the reality that we're saved and we're going to heaven, you see? Then what that can do is it can cause people, they're drawn to it, but it causes like this, sometimes a fear first, that they're not going to make it. And they were afraid and became Jews for fear of the Jews that fell upon them. Now, this is interesting. I need to point this out. This happens in the ages to come as well, that the people that are in the last days, they're in the tribulation period. Zechariah quotes and gives a prophecy about this, verse 23 of Zechariah 8. Watch this now. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days. Now, this is a picture of those days. Keep this in mind. Esther's a picture of these last days, and it happened in the book of Esther during the times of Esther, but it also will happen in the future. In Zechariah 8:23, thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all languages and of all the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. In the last days, when God is wrapping things up on this earth, Zechariah says that 10 men, 10 worldly men, will be grabbing onto the skirt of one Jew and then saying, we're coming with you because we can see that God's with you. The same thing that's going on here in verse 17 of chapter 8. Many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. They just started, hey, we want to be a Jew. We want to be one of God's people, you see. We want to be like you guys. So, now here's the interesting thing. You might be thinking, well, wait a minute. Now, this is the good news, the gospel, right? There's going to be life. There's an opportunity for life. I want you to note this. There's an opportunity for life. The proclamation that was given, listen, the proclamation that was given was only the opportunity to have life. The people had to believe it, first of all, and then they needed to really fight for it. They needed to make a stand. And the stand that they made proved that they believed what that proclamation said. But here's the thing. They still had to fight. Your opportunity for life has been declared, right? This is what we tell people when we want them to get born again, when we want them to be saved. The proclamation's been made. The opportunity for life is there, but you have to believe it. And when you believe it, then what? Well, then the fight's on, isn't it? You just picked a fight with Satan, didn't you? You think Satan's going to rest easy while you get saved? And while you live your life for the Lord now? Absolutely not. The fight has just begun, and you still have to fight, you see. And if they didn't believe that this proclamation was true, then they would have been destroyed on that day rather than live on that day. Same thing applies, doesn't it? You have to believe the good news, and then you have to apply it to your life. Otherwise, you just hear about it, and the proclamation was made, but you didn't really enjoy the reality of it because you didn't believe it and you didn't make a stand for it. Same thing, you see. How many people have heard the proclamation that there's life and opportunity to live forever? Tons, right? I mean, people you know, you've shared maybe the gospel with people, right? And you tell them, look, I can tell you this over and over, but you have to believe it. And you have to make a stand. You have to stand and say, I believe in Jesus Christ and I'm going to live for him. And the fight's on. There's going to be a battle here. And the enemy will keep trying to take me out. Just like on this day, the enemy was going to try and destroy some of the Jews. But they fought. You see, they made that stand. And this is the same thing for us. We see this over and over again. And I always picture it like, you know, those Visa cards you get in the mail. You know, they're annoying things, you know. Like, I need another Visa, like a hole in the head, you know. But they send them to you pre-approved, and they're already ready to go sometimes. They have a little sticker on them, right? But the card's there. But it says on there, doesn't it? Call this number to activate this card, right? Now, if you call the number and say, yes, I'd like to activate the card, then it's valid and you can use it, right? You can get yourself in more debt than you're already in. But here's the deal. Everybody gets the salvation card. Everybody gets it. You get one. Everybody has one. And on it is a little sticker that says, call to activate. Call who? Everyone who calls upon the name of Jesus shall be saved. You've got to call. Otherwise what? Not activated. And you might have your card and think you're a card-carrying member when you get to heaven and say, got my card. Well, you never made the call. That card is not activated. Doesn't have any value because you didn't make the call. You follow me? This is the reality of what's going on here. Everybody heard the published news that this was going to be an opportunity to live, and yet you had to believe and understand that we have to fight. We have to make a stand here, and it's worth it if you want to live. Now, in the verse 1 of chapter 9, now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary, that the Jews had rule over them that hated them. Listen to that. Those that still hated the Jews that thought that they were going to have their way on this 13th day of Adar were in for a surprise because it had been turned. Now, who turned it? Who turned it around so that the Jews would now have the dominion over these Persians? Well, God did, obviously. The decree was given, but that doesn't mean anything unless the Jews, obviously, that were there in Persia believed it and were ready to go. And God then turns it around. The Jews gathered themselves, verse 2, together in their cities throughout all provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt. And no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all the people. And all the rulers of the provinces and the lieutenants and the deputies and officers of the king helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. The officers, those Persian officials, were turning on their own people and helping the Jews out because they were afraid of Mordecai now, because Mordecai is second command in all the kingdom, and they're scared to go against him. For Mordecai, it says, was great in the king's house. And his fame went out throughout all provinces, for this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. This Mordecai became a great man. in Persia in short order. In a short period of time, everybody knew who he was and realized he was a great man of power. Thus, the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. And in Shushan, the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. That would be right there in what we would call the citadel, or the palace armament, the inside the gates and walls of the palace itself, not just the city. This would be exclusively in the palace of Shushan. 500 of the king's own men were trying to kill the Jews. They killed 500 of them right there. And watch this, Parshandatha and Dalphon and Esphatha and Poratha. These are great names. These are Persian names, by the way. And Adalia and Eridatha and Parmashta and Erisai and Aradai and Vajezda. These, now check this out. These were the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, and they were slain. They slew them. The 10 sons of Haman. Interesting that Haman has 10 sons, isn't it? But on the spoil laid they not their hand. They didn't touch the spoil. The Jews didn't. Now watch. On that day, the number of those that were slain in Shushan, the palace, was brought before the king. And the king said unto Esther, the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan, the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. That have the, what have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? He doesn't have a clue. He just knows that in the palace itself, there's 500 people dead. And he says, now, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request further? And it shall be done. King says, okay, all I know is 500 people are dead in the palace. I have no idea how many people are dead in the province. But now what do you want to do? What more do you want to do? Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according to this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. So Esther says, well, I'd like another day of this. Now, she has a reason for this, because in the palace of Shushan, 500 were destroyed. But this doesn't include the city immediately outside of the palace gates and walls. She wants to make sure that in the city, there isn't any more that want to destroy them. So she says, can we have one more day of this? And by the way, can we just hang those 10 boys up on the gallows while we're at it? And again, she wants apparently to make a showing of Haman's seed. And the king commanded it to be so, and the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Now, 10 can be the number of the law, but I think in this context, it's even more sinister, if you would. Haman is the Antichrist in picture form, is he not? His 10 sons probably are more in correlation with Daniel's prophecy about the 10-horned creature that has 10 horns, actually 10 nations that are led by a little horn. Haman would be the little horn. His 10 sons would be the other 10 nations that will be destroyed when the end of the tribulation comes to pass. Now, this is interesting. Daniel talks about the fact that there will be a 10-nation confederacy that the Antichrist will rule over. And basically, that'll be his power structure to rule the world with in the last days during the tribulation. So isn't it interesting here that Haman just happens to have 10 sons? This man who is wicked Haman, who is destroying or seeking to destroy the Jews and wipe them out of existence, that he has 10 sons. And now not only has he been destroyed, but his 10 sons have been taken out of the picture. When the great one comes at the end of the tribulation, not the phony great one, but the true great one, the one that has on his vesture the word of God. And when he comes and destroys with the word of his mouth all those that would oppose the Jews, then all of these would be dealt with, a death blow, you see. So here's the interesting thing. This is a picture, I believe, of the Gentile 10-nation government, so to speak, that will be in power again. it'll be a revived Roman Empire, if you would. Now, it's not necessarily going to be centered in Rome, like many people believe, but Rome and its empire spread all over that whole region over there, including what we now know in this context is parts of Persia and the whole Middle East was part of the Roman Empire. So, interesting. Just a side thought there. So the 10 sons were hung. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day. So the next day, they did the same thing, basically, and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey, they laid not their hands. So outside of the palace, so to speak, in the city, another 300 were destroyed. But watch, the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of the foes 75,000, but they laid not their hands on the prey. So the Jews in the province, all over the region, if you would, slew 75,000 Persians. And it doesn't say here, doesn't give us any indication that any Jews were destroyed. Interesting. Again, God's sovereign power being lived out in a group of people who are living in Persia because God has a plan. And again, you know, I look at this story, and I've pointed this out before, but is it beyond God to have this whole story take place, even though he's not mentioned by name in it, but yet he paints and weaves a picture of salvation and the last days and the Antichrist and the overcoming of him and all the rest? Is it unlike God to do this throughout the scriptures? No, of course not. He does this all the time. I find that people just aren't looking for the story oftentimes. Sometimes people will look at their Bibles and go, well, I don't know what that means. Whatever that means, you know, I don't know. Well, it's for you. The Apostle Paul said all these stories, all these things are for our learning. Every Old Testament story is for your learning, meaning there's a picture there for you to take and learn from. And isn't it fascinating when you find out what the story encompasses? It's all about what the Lord has declared throughout his word, not just parts of it. This is a whole picture, isn't it? An amazing thing. So 75,000 were killed, but they didn't touch the prey. They didn't take the spoil. They had a right to. The king's decree was very clear. They could take all the spoil. They didn't touch it. And I think the reason is that they did not want to have any means of accusation against them by the other Persians. What would this mean when the Persians that were fearful of the Jews, or when the officers were helping the Jews and the Jews were taking on those that were trying to assault them and killing them and yet not taking the spoil for themselves? What would that say to the other Persian people that were watching them? They didn't do it for the spoil. They didn't do it for what they could get out of it, right? They were only fighting for their life. That's it. So they didn't take the spoil. And on the 13th day of the month Adar, and on the 14th day of the same rested day, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews that were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, and on the 14th day thereof, and on the 15th day of the same they rested, and made it a day of feasting and gladness. So the province hadn't really heard that there was another day to go ahead and do this again, like they were doing in Shushan. So in the city, they did the kind of the war thing for 2 days, and then on the 15th day, they made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, verse 19, the Jews of the villages that dwelt in the unwalled towns made the 14th day of the month Adar a day of gladness and feasting, and a good day, and of sending portions one to another. They sent presents to each other. It was a celebration. Interesting kind of thought, though, isn't it? That in the midst of fighting for their life, so to speak, believing this decree and then fighting for their life, their gladness and their joy caused them to send things to others, which is the way it ought to be. Generosity was born out of this life-giving process that was offered to them. Now, verse 20, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, both nigh and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly. as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy. What a great promise the Lord gives us. He turns our sorrow into joy. He doesn't remove the sorrow and then replace it with joy. He turns the sorrow into joy. We talked about this not that long ago. It's an important understanding. The more sorrowful you may have to deal with things, the more sorrow you may have to endure, the more joy you ultimately have. It's one of God's blessings and promises of his perfect balance. When someone goes through something severely sorrowful, then the Lord then can take that and turn it into extreme joy. An amazing truth. Now, as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, it says, verse 22, in this month in which the sorrow was turned to joy, and from mourning into a good day, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, and of sending portions one to another, and gifts to the poor. This is the response. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them, because Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, a lot, to consume them and to destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that this wicked device which he devised against the Jews should return upon his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Wherefore, they called these days Purim, after the same name of Pur. Therefore, for all the words of this letter and of that which they had seen concerning this matter and which had come unto them. So because they cast Pur, or a lot, they called this feast the Feast of Purim, named after the casting of the lot that was supposed to be this means to destroy the Jews. But God had turned it around, obviously. And now it's a feast day to remember the deliverance that came from that death sentence. So the Jews, by the way, still celebrate this Feast of Purim to this day. It's still celebrated, which is a validation, by the way, in many respects to the book of Esther, because this is where it came from. And again, we've talked about the fact the Jews hold this book in highest esteem. So, verse 27, the Jews ordained and took upon them and upon their seed and upon all such as joined themselves unto them, so as it should not fail that they would keep these 2 days according to their writing and according to their appointed time every year, and that these days should be remembered and kept out of every generation, every family, every province, and every city, and that these days of Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. And they haven't. It's still celebrated, still going on. Then Esther the queen and the daughter of Abihail and Mordecai the Jew wrote with all authority to confirm this second letter of Purim. This is another clue, hint, that Mordecai was probably the author of the book of Esther. He wrote that letter of Purim. He also wrote other things, obviously, because it says there in verse 20, Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters and so forth. So my guess is that if we have any evidence of who wrote this book, it would be Mordecai. Who better to write it than the man who had firsthand experience in seeing all of it happen? But again, somehow all this got back to Judah, where it was kept and included in the other scriptures. Somehow it got back into the hands of the Jews. And verse 30, he sent the letters unto all Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth. So he sent the letters of Purim now, not the whole book of Esther, but the letters here, this official kind of feast declaration, to confirm these days of Purim in their times appointed according as Mordecai the Jew and Esther the queen had enjoined them, and as they had decreed for themselves and for their seed the matters of the fastings and their cry. And the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. Now, chapter 10. The king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea, and all the acts of his power and of his might, and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? So the record of this is written in the chronicles of the history of the Persian Empire. And Mordecai would be listed in there, although his name's probably written in Persian. But it is interesting that the documentation of this era includes very similar bylines to this whole story in the cultural records of Persia itself. So in other words, from the perspective of the Persian chronicler, the one who would have written this down, these events coincide. Much like whatever they keep finding in antiquity through archaeological diggings always seem to confirm, not discount, what the Bible teaches. They found something, it was a number of years ago now, they found something there in Egypt at one point that talked about a famine and how there was a man who was distributing the grain. And the whole thing kind of correlates and parallels what the Bible teaches about Joseph, you see. And again, this man's name is in Egyptian, you see. So it doesn't say Joseph, but it's an Egyptian name, but the story's the same. Just a fascinating thing. Happens over and over again throughout the archaeological findings that they keep coming up with. Always confirms what the Bible teaches. Why don't they just believe it, you know? But here's the thing. All these things are written down there. For Mordecai, verse 3, the Jew was next unto King Ahasuerus and great among the Jews and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people and speaking peace to all his seed. Now, here's the fascinating thing to me. I'm almost done. Mordecai stayed, obviously, in Persia. He's still there, according to this last part of chapter 10 here. He's still there, and he became great, second in command to the king, and spoke peace to his brethren and their seed, but it doesn't indicate that he left and went back to Judah, which would have still been according to God's will for his people. So Mordecai here, even though he's been used mightily and has accomplished something great, we still have to look at him as a flawed man. He has failed in his following after what the Lord wanted him to do, specifically about going back to Judah. And yet, God painted this whole picture in the book of Esther, using him and Esther and others that were involved to create this whole imagery and picture of his process and his purpose through man's history and all the way through until the end times. Isn't that fascinating? But here's the thing that you might want to just ponder for a moment. He's doing the same thing today, isn't he? How many of us can be used by the Lord to accomplish things that he is doing, purposes that he has planned, and yet for a great part of the time we are not in his will. We're not doing everything that he wants us to do. And people say, well, how do you know that? Well, because this would be a different world if we were. This would certainly be a different church. It would certainly be a different town. It would certainly be a different community, would it not? And yet, how faithful God is to continue working around us, maneuvering around like we're just a bunch of statues sometimes. And the Spirit of God just works around us as we're standing there for the most part. You may not make that noise. I do once in a while. But it's like we're just blockheads sometimes, you know, just not doing much of anything for the Lord, and yet he just does this work, just like I see throughout this story. Here these people are out of his will in Persia of all places, and yet he's just working things and doing things. And how did you get to be queen, Esther? I don't know. Gee, Mordecai, how did you get to be second in command in all of Persia, being a Jew? Lucky break, I guess. Gee, how is it that all of the Jews that were supposed to be destroyed in Persia didn't get destroyed? Luck of the draw, you know. God did all that, folks. Listen, he did all that without any help. Without any help. And he still does, pretty much. He does it without any help. Now, if you want to help, God's blessed and pleased to allow that to be. You can pray, you can surrender, you can submit, You can confess. You can go through the process of painfully recognizing who you are and letting God work in your flesh and drive out the junk you see and cause the Spirit to flood you and fill you and all the rest. You can partake in this, but listen carefully. More than not, people who arrive in heaven are much like Esther and Mordecai. And I always look at this as a picture of how God works this amazing thing out called rewards, crowns, if you would, which are the rewards that his saints receive for doing so much for him. Now, I've always looked at this and I've always thought, well, yeah, I can see the Apostle Paul's going to get some kind of heavy-duty crown, you know, maybe John and Peter and some other guys, you know, maybe Billy Graham, you know, but what about everybody else, you know? Well, here's the thing. This is the way our God does it, I believe. You know what a magnet does when you take it and run it through the dirt? Have you ever seen that? Ever done? I used to do it when I was a kid. It's kind of fun. Just take a magnet, wrap a little string around it, and then just pull it through the dirt. You know what happens? Little fragments of metal start clinging to the magnet, right? Little shavings, little hairline shavings of metal start drawing themselves to the magnet. So you pull it out and, hey, look, right? Kind of fuzzy with all these little metal shavings. That's kind of what God does with us. His love runs through the dirt, so to speak. And that's the magnet of his love and drawing us to himself. And amazingly, miraculously, as that magnet gets pulled through the dirt, God pulls out of that little teeny shavings and slivers of good. And keeps running it through there. And before long, it's kind of fuzzy. And what he does is he takes all those little slivers and he fashions a crown. And he gives it to you and me. And he is the only one that can do that. He's the only one that can pull that off. So when you look at this story, understand, God did this amazing thing. It wasn't Mordecai, wasn't Esther. They weren't even in the right place. They weren't even in the right region. They weren't even in the neighborhood, if you would. They were totally away from where God wanted them to be, and yet God still did this amazing work, showing forth the power of his redemption, his son, his plan, his purposes. And isn't it exciting to know that regardless of you and me and what we are or what we aren't, God's going to win anyway. He is going to establish and perform because he is faithful to finish what he started. He started with you, and it doesn't matter that you've dropped the ball because he picks it up again. You know, that's what he does. I think he follows us around picking up the balls we drop. You know? And it's just a good thing he's God, because he can just carry them all at the same time, you know. Puts it back in order, okay, you know. Well, I better do that now. Better do this. This is why, to me, this is why he is to be worshipped. He's to be praised, honored, glorified. I can't always perform the way I should. In fact, it's a difficult reality to look at, isn't it? When you start really getting down to the basics, it's just difficult to look at how much I really am in God's will versus my own. But to know that he loves me anyway and will accomplish purposes that are for my good, like he did for Esther and Mordecai, saving people in spite of what I'm doing, ministering to people in spite of me, doing things that he's accomplishing that are way beyond what I even thought about. I didn't even think about the things he thinks about. And yet he does them. And then he lets me kind of see him do it. And I think, wow, how do you do that? Because I wasn't even in the neighborhood when you did it. I wasn't even conscious when you did that. I was spiritually blocked out. I was blocked off. This is our God. Now, what that should do for me, for us, is it should cause us, like it did the children of Israel, when they saw the reality of what God was doing and how he gave them a chance to live. It should cause us to do the same thing. Rejoice, start getting glad, start getting happy, joyful, excited, and start doing like they did, for others. Start giving stuff away. Not just your stuff, but giving of yourself. Giving things. Being generous with joy. Being generous with love. Being generous with grace, mercy, kindness, gentleness. Just getting into the whole thing with the Lord should be what this causes me and you to do. See? So, Esther, he's done. So is Ezra, by the way. That was a while back. Go to the table tonight and just meet with him. Thank him for his grace. Thank him for his mercy. Remember what he's done for you. And remember this, he still does it for you. Still doing it for you. Let's pray. Father, thank you for all the goodness and grace that you pour out. And Lord, in spite of what we might be or may not be doing, it's just really about you and how you're good and how you're powerful and how you're awesome. We want to meet you now at the table and confess, Lord, that we're not what we ought to be. And the things we do, Lord, in the flesh definitely hinder what we are used in and what we may focus on. But Lord, your faithfulness is not affected by our failures, as we see in this book. Even when we're not where we should be and where we're supposed to be, you're still going to win. You're still going to accomplish your purposes and plan. I pray, Father, that we would understand that there is truly an abundance of grace and mercy. And as we come to the table, we remember why that's so. Because of your sacrifice, Lord. What you did on the cross provides that. Bless you for that. As we come now to the table, meet us there. In Jesus' name, amen.